This podcast is brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood. I'm the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Here's a quick stop press for listeners in Nelson and Tasman. Mark the 5th of August at 5:30 p.m. in your diary for a talk at Putangi Tangi Green Meadows in Stoke on the exciting prospects of deliberative democracy presented by two expert speakers. Entry by optional, Koha. Hope to see you there. It should be great. Well, today we have a very full interview with professional foresight planner Victoria Mulligan. I wound up thinking, how many more ways can my horizons be expanded by our great guests? I do hope you enjoy it. Today's guest on our Front Footing the Future series is Victoria Mulligan, and it's hard to imagine a better fit because she is, in fact, a professional futurist. Victoria has degrees spanning the arts and sciences, is a certified foresight practitioner, and as if that's not enough, she's a founder of Aotearoa Future Network and co-founder and director of Design Futures Aotearoa. Victoria regularly posts thought-leading pieces with a future focus, such as a recent one exploring different scenarios of how we might manage through and emerge from the current energy crisis. Thank you so much for joining us on Climate Matters, and a very warm welcome to the show.
Oh, kia ora, Lindsay. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
I am too. Maybe we should start by just asking you to say, what do foresight practitioners actually do, Victoria, and how might that be relevant to developing good climate policy?
So my job is to help organisations, teams, decision makers really to think more systematically and more creatively about the future so that we can make better and more well-informed decisions today. And that's so that part is really keen, because unless we are connecting our future thinking to today's decision making, it's fanciful and it's fun, but it's not very useful, you know. So the work has what is, I guess, most well known is the tracking of signals. So looking at what's shifting in technology or science, the economy, and searching for some of those early indicators that something significant is changing. Something that I think is changing in the field at the moment is that increasingly the more important part is understanding not just those trends, but how those trends and those shifts are interacting with each other. You know, the world is changing through convergences, tech and behavior and geopolitics. And when they collide, they create something genuinely new, and you couldn't have predicted it by watching any one of them in isolation.
So interesting. Well, you said at the beginning something that almost seemed a self-contradiction to me, systemically and creatively. And you want to elaborate a little on that juxtaposition?
You know, the design thinking framework of, you know, you have to be able to diverge to converge. What we know about people is that we actually can think more creatively when we have almost these invisible guardrails as well. Blank page is really, really hard for people. We know from neuroscience, in fact, that, you know, we're really good at remembering, but we're pretty rubbish at imagining. And the reason being, you can look at neuroimaging studies of our brain. If I say to you, Lindsay, I want you to imagine yourself in 20 years' time, your brain lights up in the same areas as if I had asked you to imagine a stranger. So it's no wonder, right, that we struggle to invest in uncertain opportunities, and because the future feels distant. And the part of foresight work is to make the future feel much closer. If it's close, we're far more equipped to make decisions based on it.
One of the things about forecasting is that we come up with predictions, but that's not always something that's going to equip us to handle them. There can be a gap between preparedness and prediction. Could you elaborate a little bit on those gaps?
Yeah, for sure. I think climate is a really good way to illustrate that, right? We have had warnings for decades. We have had models and projections and increasingly hard evidence. And yet, preparedness We're not quite there yet, right? It's quite different from prediction. But I think the problem is we keep conflating the two. So prediction, you know, we'll say, okay, parts of New Zealand are going to face more flooding, heat stress, we're going to see insurance retreat. Fine. We will have all of that. But preparedness asks us a different set of questions. So are councils funded and empowered to act? Are we still consenting homes in places we know will be uninsurable? Do health services understand what heat is going to mean for vulnerable people? So the problem isn't that our leaders and our decision makers lack data. We've got all of that. We can see more about what is coming down the pipe than ever before in history. But the problem is that when that moment of disruption arrives, it lands on the doorstep, no one's ever practiced that decision of what to do. So they freeze and then you revert to what you've done the last time, which in so many cases now is wrong.
Maybe we should practice what I call an orange traffic alert, where we might think, okay, if there's a shortage, what is it? What are we going to do personally to cope with it? I'm pleased to hear you say we ought to be practicing those things too.
Totally. I talk about rehearsing quite a bit, you know, because, and I think that's where foresight often gets mistaken for prediction, right? We use things like scenarios to get decision makers in the room before a crisis, working through what would we do if this happened, which is exactly to your point of traffic lights. We put together these fuel security scenarios earlier this year, you know, to look at what that Strait of Hormuz disruption might play out like, right? Now, those scenarios, they weren't designed to predict what was going to happen. They're designed to surface decisions that might need to be made at different stages in a disruption, right? So what might a government have done in week two and month three, you know? The value in foresight in some of these tools is not so much getting the future right. The value is in when a storm hits, and increasingly when you're seeing multiple storms hit at once, you're not designing that decision framework at the same time you're trying to deal with it, right? You fail to prepare for things that we know are plausible.
I think you and I have both come across Nick Agar, who has used the term imagination insurance for helping safeguard ourselves for what might be coming. And do you have any comments to add in that space at all, Victoria?
They're not prediction scenarios, right? They are imagination infrastructure. Back to, you know, that structured ways of stretching our thinking, those guardrails are really helpful to put us into a future before that future arrives, right? And that's super important because once you can see different futures, different pressures, it can help you ask much better questions. Across all of these plausible futures, what are the moves that would be robust across all of them? What would we deeply regret if we didn't do it early enough? Much harder to grapple with if you don't have something tangible to work in. So in terms of that imagination infrastructure, I think scenarios is a super good example of a tool that can help you expand that thinking.
Definitely. You and Jesse have done a great job putting out that scenarios document. If you feel like it, I'd love to chat a little bit about that, because you basically were using the Straits of Hormuz crisis to say, well, our country might unfold in different ways as a result.
The point of those scenarios, we did them so that they were accessible to groups that don't usually have access to that sort of model of thinking. You know, things like scenario planning are much more common in big commercial outfits than they are in even public sector bodies. But I'm thinking like councils, I'm thinking of philanthropic not-for-profits. We wanted to make it, a bit more accessible to people. So we looked specifically at what a fuel disruption that is short and contained might look like versus what if it compounded over months, and then looked at, well, what if institutional trust holds, or what if it fractures? So if you just imagine a 2x2 matrix that helped us map out what each of those scenarios could look like. Seeing some of those headlines published almost every day that we wrote into these scenarios.
I was going to say, they're in your scenarios, aren't they? I'd like to just pick up a little bit, because one of the things that I think listeners, it's good to understand, is that as well as one dimension, you mentioned whether the crisis is contained or becomes compounding, but the other is how much society holds together and maintains trust as against becomes fractured, isn't it?
Now, trust landscape is just so challenging here in New Zealand. Like, our trust is massively in decline. we're not looking good. Like, you know, even relatively speaking to other, you know, OECD countries, we trust plays a massive, massive role.
This is a podcast series that likes to point at policy outcomes for government. Do you have any pointers in that space?
I don't think by any stretch that our current political system has a shortage of plans, right? We have annual plans and strategies and targets and dashboards, and they're all useful to some degree. But to date, the policy landscape, the government landscape, as well as the commercial one, we've all been operating on the assumption that the world is relatively ordered. And that doesn't hold anymore. So the way that we plan and that we think about policies, you know, we have really been able to just track first order impacts, right? Because nothing really changes. We can't do that anymore. And I think what foresight adds to this conversation is that discipline of mapping, you know, what happens next? So what is the second and the third order consequences that flow on from the first, right? And I think that our policy environment perhaps could do with a longer term intergenerational horizon.
For listeners that aren't quite familiar with the terminology, could you expand a little on what you mean by first order consequences and second and third order consequences?
A fuel disruption, for example, you know, that happens. That's the signal. That's the thing that happens. Then we see higher freight costs. You know, that's the first order hit of this fuel disruption. Right. But what's the next order implication of that? So it might be rising food prices. And then what might be the third order implication after that? Well, we see household stress. And then after that, you know, what we just talked about, eroding trust. You know, we don't trust the government to be able to manage this crisis. You know, it can be a flow-on effect from a simple fuel disruption.
Almost everybody I know who gets involved with the climate space, one of the first things they say is, oh my God, everything's connected, isn't it?
Totally. Absolutely. And I guess as a society, we're really good at saying, okay, well, this doesn't fit or something is wrong, so we need to build something new. We have this inclination to always want to add something and add another and add another. But actually, it might be more useful now to be thinking about what do we stop doing? And I think they're really, really hard conversations to have. But if we don't have them early, they're often made more sort of abruptly, and often when it's in that crisis mode, more unfairly. But what I will say that Futures adds here is that when you are having some of these hard conversations with a Futures lens, I do notice less conflict or unhelpful conflict because we're talking about something that hasn't happened yet. And I think we can be a little bit more productive in disagreement when we are talking about a future situation rather than sort of reacting to a current crisis now.
I'd like to just sort of hang on to the policy thread a little bit in terms of having the difficult discussions early and so on. Do you have some advice for government? How would you steer a government in terms of better equipping their policy with that sort of forward thinking?
If we only stay at a very structural level, which I think it's very easy to produce like these sweeping statements that, you know, we have an aging population. It sounds really significant, but I just don't think that that helps people make decisions on Monday morning. We need the so what, you know. But then equally, if we stay in the detail, which we do see a bit as well, you miss that pattern entirely, and then you just end up, I guess, firefighting. So I think in a policy lens, they would encourage people to hold that tension, to be able to move between both. What foresight gives us is that lens of, hey, what's the biggest pattern? And then how do we bring that back to practical decisions or practical moves that we can make today to prepare for what might unfold? I think one of the maybe structural problems with climate policy is that the costs of acting are immediate and they're quite visible, right? So we feel higher prices, you know, we have to change our behaviour. And the costs of doing nothing are quite delayed. They're also really unevenly distributed. It's so much easier to deny it because it's in the future. Mm. That foresight lens makes those future costs become very real and very present.
I think this is my cost management background in construction coming out. Mm. But when I hear people say, oh, that climate action costs too much, I have two recorded questions that I replay. The first one is, over what time frame does it cost too much? And the second is, what's the cost of failing to take that action?
To me, you were just saying you have answer on repeat. Mine is always compared to what, you know, expensive compared to what? Because not acting, quote, is not neutral, right?
I don't know where we should move from there, Victoria. I'm interested in the question of dealing with complexity. You touched on that before and said, you know, at one stage we would just deal with a first order effect, but then we get other ones almost like being hit by different waves. Do you want to expand on the area of complexity and how we should handle it?
Yeah, I really think this is one of the most important things that we need to start getting people's heads around, right? And there is a concern, I certainly have a concern, that people just think a polycrisis is lots of bad things happening at once. That polycrisis is when the risks or the shifts start to interact with each other, right? And that the combined impact exceeds the sum of each individual risk. I think it's additive. It's not additive, it's exponential is the word I'm looking for. It's important with respect to climate because it makes climate really hard to govern. It's a really big problem, but that problem amplifies every other problem it touches.
Absolutely.
Totally. So we have a flood and that damages houses, right? But it also stresses the insurance system. And then it impacts the household wealth and how we spend, which then has an impact on local government revenue. Like there's just so much that is going on. And most of our organizations, public and private, had this period of relative stability. So they've only been built to handle one failure at a time. It's all designed for single system stress. The systems that you would normally call on are already under pressure simultaneously, right?
Totally. Yeah.
So I think the more that we can get our heads around that exponential change and impact that these compounding trends have, we'll start to realize that we need different models to be able to manage that complexity.
Well, I'm totally with you. And in fact, I don't know if you caught up with it, but just about a week ago, or maybe 2 weeks ago, the Climate Change Commission put out a report basically saying to the government, you're getting sucked into a pattern of putting all your funds into repairing damage, and you really should be front-ending the problems more so that we minimize the damage or avoid it. And that's in a way related to what you're just talking about, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And that sort of focus on prevention, it's just like in terms of ROI, like you get so much more of a return on investment and not just in climate, you know, but I think what I do a fair bit in sort of the health sector, I think health is quite an underappreciated lens around climate risk. You know, heat is affecting older people in homes without insulation. It's affecting our outdoor workers, our kids in schools. Like it really just does touch everything. And if we had the capacity to invest in more of those preventative, we would be in a different place.
We got into this discussion when we were talking about complexity. A lot of government procedures are siloed into different government departments. And I'm wondering if we need a department of integration or some variation on that theme, rather than just relying on cabinet ministers holding the right conversations across the cabinet table. Do you have any thoughts in that direction?
Yeah, well, I mean, interestingly, I have two thoughts. We actually used to have, I'm going to forget the words, but I think it was back in the 1980s, we had a futures commission, you know, that was...
Oh, we did, didn't we?
Yeah, we did, you know, responsible for thinking about some of these long-term issues and how we can better prepare for them. Now, that is long gone. And then we had the long-term insight briefings. Now, we had about 19 of them, and the role of the long-term insight briefings was to have chief execs be able to present to their ministers on, you know, the long-term implications of policy, what was coming down the pipe, not to make recommendations, but again, just to paint the landscape of what was coming down the pipe. But what it did do is it provided us as a country with some of that infrastructure, some of that support around long-term thinking. Now, one of the criticisms that was angled at the long-term insight briefings was that they weren't actually cross-cutting enough. I think some of those sort of ways of thinking about the future, again, systematically enabling a little bit of creative thinking as well and imagination in terms of, you know, what possible futures might look like, will be really, really helpful for our policymakers. Yeah, and I mean, you'd know more about this than me as well, Lindsay, but there's a lot of talk now around new democratic models as well. I think there was somebody in the country quite recently who was talking about citizen assemblies, and I understand there is, again, challenges to that. Like there is with all new models, we do need to debate how they will land. You know, we have a treaty in place, you know, Te Tiriti Te Puatangi.
You probably don't know this, but I'm involved with a group in the Nelson region, and we've got funding to set up a workshop that can be replicated in different council regions to upskill people in citizens' assemblies and deliberative democracy.
We need a bit of an upending, right? You sort of hope for something bold, and I think it does need to be bold if we're going to make any substantive change.
And you did talk earlier about the fact that we are not scoring well on the trusted government space. And this is one strategy that might help build that trust again.
Oh, absolutely. And I think I'll bring you back to the way that I think good foresight happens is not by giving a foresight project to a consultant to go away and do it on their own and come back with, hey, these are my recommendations for the future of health, for example. But I think it is far more sticky. It lands with a far broader audience if you have actually brought people into that process of foresight and futures thinking. Yeah, and scenarios are a great example of that. You know, you can present, and I've seen it happen, you can present scenarios to a client, for example, who have not had any part of that process of scenario development. And they look at it and they go, well, this is fun. This is really interesting. And then it just gets filed on a shelf. However, if you've had the senior leadership in those meetings and those workshops, they read it and they're like, yeah, I can see this happening. I know why this is written in this way because I was involved in it. You know, so likewise, any sort of process where you are imagining possible futures, the more people that you have in that process, the more robust they are, the better they will land with an audience. And that is what you need if you want people to use that futures thinking to make better decisions today.
Wow, that's so cool. I really like that. That's in a way talking about individuals' buy-in, in a sense. The reason I'm saying that is I'd be interested to get your views on getting political buy-in to good climate policy. Because they say if we do what's really needed, we won't get voted back in again.
It's a problem we all grapple with, right? We have these electoral cycles. They don't match climate timescales. And you have
not by a matter of centuries, do they?
No, totally. But our political incentives are all built around these three-year horizons. I mean, I don't know. We need new models. Like, we are designing institutions and political frameworks that if they're going to be equipped to serve their purpose, they need to be able to hold those timescales, both of them, the 3 years and the 300 years, simultaneously. One of the ways that we're sort of playing with approaches that avoid that circumstance is how do we make futures work not just more accessible, as in written, move to approaches that allow people to experience different futures, an emotional response to them around, you know, designing futures, you know, from like full augmented reality, virtual reality, you know, things that are far more lo-fi, plaques on walls. And if you can feel that, you're more likely to recall that, which changed the way in which you make decisions. And that decision stuff, I think, is just so important.
I did wonder if you'd like to comment on the challenges that people face of engaging with the dire prospects of what might be coming. I had the privilege of being on a podcast with Joelle Gergis, who is an Australian climate scientist. And I remember she said that her day job was staring into the void. She found it also, not only that was a pretty freaky thing to be doing, but it was doubly frustrating because officialdom didn't seem to take much notice of what the people who saw this were actually experiencing. Do you have any comments in that space of how you keep your own emotional grounding when you're looking at dire prospects?
I do find it emotionally taxing, I won't lie. I don't think that the answer is to look away. There is a discipline in being able to look clearly without becoming paralyzed. If this is plausible, what do we do now? You know, it's around agency, making sure that we stay connected to that agency we have to make these choices. It's the best we can do. And just to end probably on a hopeful note, because I am conscious that so much in climate, so much in foresight and futures can feel heavy. But I do really think the opportunity for Aotearoa is very real. You know, we have the scale that allows us to move really quickly. I think we have Mataranga Māori and Indigenous knowledge systems. And then we also have masses of scientific capability and community strength in this country. I think we are well equipped to prepare and protect things and make choices while we still can.
That's a wonderful note on which to end our conversation, I think. Thank you. It's been just a real delight talking with you, and thank you so much for making time to join us on this series. It's been great.
Oh, likewise. Thank you for having me.
Once again, we've had the privilege of a wonderfully talented guest. And I don't know about you, but I kept being reminded of the comments of Mirjana Stevens and the close parallels between what she was saying and what Victoria was just saying. Well, coming up in the next interview, we have Dr. Catherine Knight, who's spearheaded the very recent Reality of Everything Symposium. And then the week after that will be John Lang, who is a barrister, a climate law specialist, and a mover and shaker in the climate field. I do hope that you can join me for those episodes. And as always, kia kaha for the climate. And as you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
This podcast was brought to you by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air. Other great local podcasts are available through our website, freshfm.co.nz.